Yes. Okay, we're on Gemara Makkos, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. We're on the last Mishnah. Okay, so certain rules about court procedures. Okay, number of cases here. This is not hard, Gemara. Misha Nigmar Dino. Let's say a person was sentenced, he was judged, he's supposed to die. Bezin says, you're going to die. But what happens? He escapes. Ubarach, he escapes. And they're not able to execute him. Runs away. Okay. Well, and while he runs away, our computer has frozen.
Let him escape.
Well, what's going to happen is he's going to go to another court. He ends up in another court. Okay.
He's not going. They catch him.
Well, whatever. However it turns out, he ends up in another court. Okay, here we go. Oh, and I'm sorry. This is that's the second case. Well, just give one more second here. Uva lifnei oso bezdim. And then he comes before the very same court that originally sentenced him. He was recaptured. And they brought him back to the court. So you might think, because if you remember in Sanhedrin, there's a lot of things we do last minute to try to save the guy's life. If you remember, for example, even as they're taking him out to the place of execution, which is far away, but if he says, you know, I think I have something I could say in my defense, so we still bring him back. So you see, we go overboard to try to save the guy. So we might think, oh, he's being brought back to the court. Well, maybe we should, maybe look at things over again, you know, because he's been away for a while. So no, ain't so strenestino. They don't reconsider the sentence to see if maybe we can find new ways to acquit him. No, that nothing has changed. The fact that he ran away and come back, and you'll see why in a minute, why we're going to think maybe we should think to retry it. Because you're wondering, well, why would you think to retry it? You'll see. But the law is he comes back to the same court, you don't retry the court, and we execute him. Finished. That's case number one. Case number two. Kol makom sheyamdu shnayim v'yomru. Let's say two witnesses just get up in the middle of any random city, and they go to the Jewish court, two witnesses, and they say, Me'idim anu be'ish ploni, we test about so-and-so, shenig mardino be'bezin shel ploni, that we want to testify about this other guy, that in another court we saw that he was judged to be killed in another court. And we'll even give you more information. Uploni, uploni, and so-and-so and so-and-so were the witnesses in that case that showed that the guy was guilty of a capital crime. And the Besdin convicted him of that crime. But he ran away. And he just happens to be in this city. He's gone incognito. He's in this city. And you think he's a fine, upstanding member of the community. Well, he was convicted 3 years ago of a crime. And these were, and they proved, they said, this and this court. It's not just saying, this and this court. This and this were the witnesses. We watched the whole procedures. And there he is, right here. Okay, what do we do to this fellow? Any other important comments? Anyway, Hare Zeyeherag, the person gets killed. Gets killed because these two witnesses are giving us bona fide testimony that this guy was convicted of a crime already. Now, that a person can be executed through a second pair of witnesses testimony that he was convicted by a first pair is true only regarding the crime of murder. We'll see. For other capital crimes, I would require that the original pair testify against him. Okay, fine. That's a detail, but he can be executed. That's the second case. Yeah.
Just to understand, like, the power of the witnesses to testify. If they say this in this case, if they say that, and then do we say their testimony is so powerful we don't have to check it out with that Beit Din, or if it's possible to check it out with that Beit Din, we go there and say, like...
That's up to the Beis Din there to decide what they want to do.
But they can technically, let's say, just kill the guy based on this guy's two testimony.
How is it... Well, I want to ask you a question. How is it different than when two guys walk into a court and say somebody killed them, we kill them based on their testimony?
But if you can go out and check the Beit Din, like, are you obligated to do that?
Well,
if they can easily check the records there.
Nothing's easy there. There's no computers, you know. The court in Tzfat, and here's the court in Beersheba. Okay, that's not called easy.
go.
Right? But, you ask them questions. First of all, just like you're asking witnesses who watched the crime, is there any way we can verify what those witnesses have been saying? Let's say a regular crime, regular murder. Two people come in and say, we saw the murder. Can you go anywhere to verify if they're telling the truth? No. We take them separately. We cross-examine them, and we try to see if we can trip them up or whatever. So the same thing when they're going to come into the court, it's not just they say one line.
Yeah,
they say, okay, take one guy separately. Okay, I'd like to know exactly the names of the two witnesses. What are those two witnesses wearing when they were testifying in the court? Every single detail is no different than a murder scene than the courtroom scene. So why would even need to verify? Based on what you're saying, so I guess every murder case besides the two witnesses, we'd have to do a whole investigation and this and that to see if we can corroborate what the witnesses are saying. We never do that. That the Torah is saying two witnesses, their word is the gold standard. We assume people don't lie. That is the default position. So now, why should it be any different? So therefore... I'm sorry?
Wouldn't it be much easier to send them back to the original base camp?
Like I said, from Be'er Sheva to Tzfat is not a very easy thing. And you know what? The guy could escape again. If he escaped, why do you push it? This is not like, why should we deal with it? Send it back somewhere else. You deal with it. Right?
The whole process they went through with
AIM. I'm just saying, why? If the guy escaped, the witnesses says he escaped, right? So why would you schlep it back to another court? What's the purpose of it? What would be gained? I want to know what would be gained. Again, we are having a problem here. The problem is because we live in such a dishonest world, we assume everybody's lying. We assume everybody's lying. You don't even assume to begin with they were telling the truth. So that's a major problem. We have a Torah-based problem. I'm not saying there's not reason. Obviously, we couldn't run such a Torah-based rule in countries like Canada and in United States or Europe or in, because it's a goyish world. This, you have to remember, this Eidus is for Jews, not for non-Jews. Non-Jews cannot testify. I wonder why. I know it's a very racist statement. It's a racist statement. We don't believe non-Jews because they don't have divine souls. They're not going to have the same type of conscience. They just don't have it. They have one thing. How do you get ahead in life? All right? So, and as it is, they don't even keep the seven Noachide laws. So then what do you want? A Jew has a divine soul, and a Jew is not going to lie. Finished. So you got to get used to that fact. I know you've been in business, and the Jewish people were the worst ones, and they cheated you the most, and all that. Okay, but there is this understanding. But then again, if the Jewish people get to a point where they become so decrepit and so dishonest, then the best, that's when, well, eventually what happens, and they start killing left and right, and the Sanhedrin finally disbands. But when you do have a Sanhedrin, and there is rule of law, and there is a temple, and there is a divine presence, and the Jews realize, you can't get away with things. So that's what you just got to understand, that according to Torah law, we believe people. So we believe people. We don't do these big investigations. We bring the special SUI unit, with special investigating unit. Yeah, SIU. Right? SIU, and we're going to take blood samples and this and that. Sure says, do we got two witnesses? Fine. So anyway, so that's the point. All right. Yes.
Long question.
It's okay.
In the first case, the two witnesses go to the city where he found refuge or whatever he went.
No, the first case. First case, we bring them back. Remember, first case is the guys are captured and brought back to the same court.
What for?
They caught him. They caught
him. They execute him. Why?
But they have to execute him in a court. You can't execute him on the street. Let's say the court in Toronto was here. Let's say this is the Besdin. Let's say this is the Besdin. We rule the guy gets killed.
Right.
And then he escapes.
Right.
So we find him in Mississauga.
Okay.
So now we have to bring him back because right over there is the execution place next to the Besdin.
Bring him to the execution place.
That's you bring him back to the court just to make sure it's the same guy. You have to bring him back to the court to know that we have the right guy. The best has to say, they have to at least ask, is this the guy that you guys convicted last week? Yes. That's all you need to know. You got to bring him back to the court. It's not, we don't open up the case. We don't do anything. The court and the expert is right next to each other. It's not like we're bringing back to the court to now retry the case. We don't retry. We just say, is this the guy? Yes, finish. Now we kill him. Goodbye. That's all. Nothing more. Okay, second case, we're in another court and they testify about something, so we're going to kill him right there in that court.
Okay. I'm going to throw a wheel and spin a wheel in the wheel. What happens if two other witnesses say no?
If
two other witnesses
say what? Let him say it.
That the other testifiers, witnesses,
were
not there.
Then they could get killed. They could get killed too. Sure. That's why they have to say the details in this and this court, this and this witnesses, this and this day, for sure. Okay, that's the first half of the Mishnah. Now, second half of the Mishnah is not really connected to that. So it's a new idea. Sanhedrin noheges be'eretz ubechutzlarz. There can be a Sanhedrin. Remember, there's different types of Sanhedrin. A lower Sanhedrin is of 23 judges, and they have the ability to convict for capital crimes. Okay, and you have them all around Eretz Yisrael. So we're not talking about the big Sanhedrin of 71. That's in Yerushalayim. But a Sanhedrin that can convict someone of a capital crime applies both in Eretz Yisrael and outside Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so if you're in Bavel, for example, you could do the same thing. Now, you got to remember, though, here, look at the footnote. The court of 23, they can judge capital cases, and they had to be with smicha the way it was in Eretz Yisrael. They had to be very smart. But you have to remember, you can only get smicha in Eretz Yisrael. Smicha cannot be given outside of Eretz Yisrael. So the Mishnah senior judges who got smicha in Eretz Yisrael could judge even outside the land of Eretz Yisrael. However, they could judge capital cases outside only as long as the Great Sanhedrin still stood in the Holy Temple. So you see what's going on. You have to have the big Sanhedrin in the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, once they exist, now smicha can be given out in Eretz Yisrael, and those with smicha in Eretz Yisrael could now go outside of Israel and set up a court over there. No problems with that. So that's rule number one. Good, just remember that. You'll see why that's going to come into play later. And there is a certain connection to the first part of the Mishnah. Now, what would we say is a successful Sanhedrin? So we're told, Sanhedrin ha-horeges echas b'shavua. If a Sanhedrin executes someone once in every 7 years, not a week, but 7 years. If 7 years pass, and within 7 years, they have executed someone, they've convicted someone, we say nikros chovlanis. It's called a destroyer court. In other words, they're executing too often. Why? Because, number one, the court should always seek ways of exonerating the defendant. Now, you got to remember, it wasn't like there was the 50 murders a week over here. Like, murder was an unusual thing. It was supposed to be an unusual thing. So how many murder cases would you get even in 7 years? Okay, that's very important to understand. So when this procedure is adhered to, you're really questioning properly. Executions are rare. If a court executes too frequently, meaning once in 7 years is already too frequent or more often, it's a sign either that the court is not sufficiently acquainted with the intricacies of capital judgment to know how to ask the questions, or that is not trying hard enough to find a defense for the defendant. Therefore, merits the title destroyer court. However, if it should happen that despite the court's deliberations, the evidence is so strong that the court must convict and execute, even if this means putting to death 1,000 criminals on a single day, the court is obligated to do so and no blame attaches to it. That's the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah. I would add a little point to this. You know, the Sanhedrin certainly has a job to rule in capital cases. But a Sanhedrin also has a job to educate the masses. It's a very important thing you have to realize. You know, it's not enough to execute people. It's important to run the school systems where the children from a young age are explained clearly how evil murder is, and it has to be made real to them. And the Sanhedrin should take regular visits to the cheders and to the schools, and to see, do children have a certain God awareness and God fearedness? And if they see things are wrong, the school should make changes there. That's the real, where the real job is meant to be. Because obviously there is a contradiction over here. What do I mean to say? You see, the Torah has countless times says, for this sin you get put to death. For this sin you put this. For this sin you put to death. A lot of death penalties in the Torah. Yet, as we learned in Sanhedrin, look how far we go to get the guy off the hook. And really, it's almost impossible to kill a guy, even if he's a killer. So what's going on over here? Do you want to kill the guy, or do you want? In other words, according to the Torah, said, this die, this die, this die. Oh, man, we've got like 30, 35, I don't know, lots of death penalties, right? But then you go to Sarah and says, well, you know, you shouldn't kill a guy too often. Well, what do you mean? We got killers. What do you want us to do with it? The answer is that by the Torah writing how many death penalties are, that's what they're telling the educators. Get it through people's heads. As a little kid, they got to know. Just like you don't put your hand in a fire, you would never ever think to kill another Jew. And you explain how precious is a Jewish soul. All these things of education, and because every week, every year, they go through the Parsha. And Parsha says, because if you do this, Hashem finds this such a despicable act that if you do it, you should lose your life. To impress how despicable it is. Now, the children understand how despicable it is, you're not going to have people killing people. And if you are, you know, there's a good likelihood that they're not guilty, etc. So I think that's also, through the lines, very important. It's not just, like the Rambam says, what if there's a real guilty people? Yeah, but how does it come that you have so many people killing? Where does it come from? So if you're a liberal, what do you say? Make it a socialist country, right? And then the government kills everybody instead. It's very interesting. You don't have too much murder in socialist countries because the government just kills everybody. So they only leave the robots to live. Anybody who opens their mouth, dead. So more people get killed in socialist countries than in free countries. But and when you just kill like that, you don't have to go to court either. You don't have to make a trial. The government says, we just kill you. Finished. But so therefore, it shouldn't be a big docket. Really, the Bezin shouldn't have anything to adjudicate on. You know, if they're doing their job, so then what are they doing? They're doing job. So, well, we're going to go to this school today. We're going to go to this school tomorrow. We're going to this school tomorrow. We're going to work on some shalom bias in this family over here, so the husband doesn't kill the wife. And then but you have that in Canada. You don't have any of that. There's a disconnect. Only after the crime, then we're going to deal with it. So, what is that going to help? So that's part of the issue over here, that they're doing their job. That, I believe, is the deeper understanding of that Mishnah. So you shouldn't kill too often. Once every 7 years, that's way too much. That's what the Tanakhama says. Wait a minute. Rabbi Lezer ben Azariah Omer. No. Echad l'shivim shana. Once in 70 years. Now, this statement is a little bit unclear, and the Gemara is going to ask, what does he mean? Does he mean to argue and say, no, not once every 7 years, but once every 70 is too much and that's not good? Or is he saying, no, it should be once every 70 years? Then that's okay.
No, it can be that.
So that's the more is going to debate. We'll leave it for later. I'm just telling you, it's an ambiguous statement because he didn't say, for example, once every 70 years is called a chovlanis.
Right.
No.
So we don't know what he meant. Could he mean, he could mean to say once every 70 is too much, or no, maybe once every 70 is just right. We're not clear.
You can't say that.
We're not clear. We'll see. Okay. Comes along Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva. They have a really interesting spin on this. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva Omrim, they said, you know what? Now, there already was no Sanhedrin in their days. There was no Beis Hamikdash in their days. But they said, Ilu hayunu b'Sanhedrin, had we lived when there was a Sanhedrin, lo nerag odom me'olam, no one would ever be killed. Interesting. Why? Commentaries say, because we would have cross-examined the witnesses with questions that they could not possibly answer. That would for we disqualify that. We'll see. The Gemara is going to say what kind of questions do they ask. Alternatively, we would have cross-examined them so relentlessly that it would have eventually contradicted each other, thereby invalidating their testimony. Oh, I'm sorry. Rabbi Tamar and Kiva were in fact members of the Great Sanhedrin. Certainly, at the time it was located in Yavne after it was destroyed, and possibly even beforehand. However, they were not, as Rashi adds, members as at the time it performed executions. Ah, that's the point, because the Talmud already said Sanhedrin ceased adjudicating capital cases 40 years before the destruction. So therefore, there wasn't. So fine. So they say we would have made sure nobody got killed. Shimon Gamliel Omer, guess what, guys? If you would have done what you would have done, Afhein Marvin Shoch Davizu, you would have increased the amount of people who got killed because the criminals would know that there's never going to be any repercussions. We just make sure we go to the Ninth Circus Court, and they'll make sure, the liberal court will make sure the guy gets off and nothing's going to happen to him. So in other words, just as there's a mitzvah of the court to exert itself to save an innocent man from being executed undeservedly, so was there a mitzvah of them to punish the guilty in order to instill fear in other would-be criminals. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's concern is particularly with allowing murderers to escape execution. Murder concerned him more than other crimes in this respect, because murder is both sinful against Hashem and destructive to mankind. Now, Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Kiva seem undisturbed by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's argument. Right? Tiferes Yisrael suggests this because there's a law that when the evidence for guilt against an accused murderer is compelling, but the court cannot execute him due to a technical legal technicality, such as where the witness is tripped up on questions inessential to the conviction, what was the color of his shirt, the defendant is not freed. Instead, he's put to death indirectly. Remember we said? If there's technically, he's locked in a cell and fed scant amounts of bread and water until his stomach shrinks. Remember that we had that? Yeah. Afterwards, he's fed barley. When this food is devoured by the starving prisoner, it swells and causes his stomach to burst, killing him. The prospect of this treatment is a significant deterrent to would-be murderers, according to Reb Tarfon from Rabbi Kiva. Remember we said that even they get off with technicalities, the Bezin has their, what do you call it, the, not the right, the... you know, that's a better word. Discretion. The discretion to get rid of him in another way. In other words, there's the four ways you're supposed to kill the way the Torah says you're supposed to kill. That gives complete kapara. And this guy's, you think he's off the hook. So therefore, there's ways to have discretionary powers to get the guy killed in another way.
The worst way for the guy.
In a certain way. Okay, anyway, so that's why they could say. So even if they asked a lot of questions, but... we would have. So it's interesting. You have to now have a debate. What does it mean it's a murderer's court? When we gave him the four capital punishments or different punishments, you can see where it's going both the ways. Okay, that's the Mishnah. So we had like four different ideas in the Mishnah. Now, the little Gemara that's left that takes us to the bottom of the page. We're going to get into a first discussion over here to the very first case. There appears to be a contradiction. Let's go back to the first statement again. It says if the guy was convicted in court number A, he runs away, they catch him, and he brings him back to court number A, we kill him. Now, what's the implication of that? Why did it say he came back to court A? What if we caught him and just brought him back to court B? What would happen? Would we kill him or not? Would we open up the case or not? We know he's the killer, but would we open up the case if he came in a court?
We already established we don't. We decide he's guilty.
No. Again, the Mishnah's case said he escaped from court A.
Right.
He's recaptured and brought back to court A. We don't reopen the case.
Yeah, for sure.
What's the implication? What if he escaped?
No, we execute him. That's why you don't.
Yes,
yeah.
Because we don't open up the case again. Right. What if he ran away, got captured far away, they bring him to court B?
Mm-hmm.
They brought him to court B, and we know this is the guy. We know this is the guy. We know this is the guy. How we know, it doesn't matter. We know it's the guy. Now, the implication is only in the same court we don't reopen it. Because if it's in a different court, we could have said he was brought back even to a different court. Why does the Mishnah say he was convicted and he's brought back to the same court? We don't reopen it. Why didn't you say better that even if he's caught by another court, brought back to another court, we execute him? Must be in another court. We would reopen it. Why? Because it's different rabbis, different judges. Maybe they'll find out something they didn't find out. So anyway, that's what the implication. Lifnei also bezin hudein sos. It would appear from the Mishnah, since it said he was caught and brought back to the same court, that's when he's in the same court, they don't reopen the case. Implying, hal lifnei bezin acher sosim. But if he comes in front of a different court, they would reopen it to see what it is. But the problem is, we have to look at the seifa of our Mishnah. Hotani seifa, what did the end of our Mishnah say? Call Malcolm Shamdu Shnaim V'Yomer. Any place where two witnesses get up and say, Ma'anidi Manu Esish Ploni, they say, we're going to testify so and so, that he was convicted in another court. Shenig Mardino Bavesin Shal Ploni, that he was already convicted in another court. Uploni, Ploni Adav, and so and so and so are the witnesses. What do we say? Harez and Eric, he is killed. Which clearly says that's no different than being captured. If you have two witnesses saying it there, we do not open it. So if we don't open it in another court, why are we implying we would open another court from the first case of the Mishnah?
Yeah.
So that's seems to be a self-contradiction. The first case says if he comes back to the same court, we don't reopen the case, implying if he came back to another court, we would. But then the second card say, what two witnesses say, this is the guy who killed, blah, blah, blah. We don't reopen it. So we have to say a little bit of a dochic answer. Amar Abaye, Abaye says, Lokasha, it's not a question. We have to know what it means, a different court. Kan be'eretz Yisrael, the first part of the Mishnah, is speaking where the court we're speaking to is located in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, and once it's in Eretz Yisrael, then we would reconsider a second court. In other words, the first case is speaking in Eretz Yisrael. If a guy is convicted and he's brought back in Eretz Yisrael to the same court, he's convicted because it's the same court.
Right.
But if he be in another court in Eretz Yisrael, then we would reopen it. In Eretz Yisrael, we would reopen it.
The conclusion is still weird.
But no, we'd reopen the case and reconsider it. If it comes to the same conclusion, we kill him. But we would reconsider and hear it again, another court in Eretz Yisrael. But the second case that says he goes to another court, we kill him, Kan b'chutz la'aretz, that's speaking outside of Eretz Yisrael, where the court is now coming, what he was originally convicted in Eretz Yisrael, but now he's in a court outside of Eretz Yisrael. Then we don't reopen the case. So reopening depends, where is the second court? If the second court is in Chutz La'aretz, we're not going to reopen it. If the second court is in Eretz Yisrael, we do reopen it. What's the difference? The Tanya, for we learned in a brisa of the following. Rabbi Yehuda ben Dostoy Omer Mishum Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach. Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Dostoy, says in the name of Shimon ben Shetach, if a criminal who was convicted, Barach me Eretz Chutz La'aretz, if he ran from, he was convicted in Eretz Yisrael, he runs away, and now he's in Chutz La'aretz, and the Bezin knows that that's the guy, Ein Sosin, we do not reopen the case. On the other hand, Mechutz La'aretz, La'aretz, what if he ran from outside of Israel, was convicted in Bavel, now he's caught in the land of Israel, Sosin Estino, we do reconsider the case. Why? What's the difference? Beautiful answer. Mipnei Schuso Shel Eretz Yisrael, the merit of Eretz Yisrael, the land of Eretz Yisrael, the Avira of Eretz Yisrael, makes people smarter, and in that merit, they'll be able to find a loophole. According to this explanation, the first part of the Mishnah is really discussing a case in which the first trial took place outside of Eretz Yisrael. And now the defendant is brought before a court inside Eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah teaches that if he comes before the same court that tried him the first time, in other words, the court had previously been situated in the diaspora, and subsequently relocated to the Holy Land, the same judges, he's not retried. However, if when recaptured, he's brought before a different court in Eretz Yisrael, he's granted a retrial, since the extramarital of the Holy Land may stand by him to cause the new judges to find reason for acquittal. Nevertheless, this extra merit is insufficient to cause the same court to find new grounds for acquittal. This is why the Mishnah needs to tell us that he's not retried by the same court. The second half of the Mishnah discusses a case in which the court before whom the witnesses testified was located outside of Eretz Yisrael, regardless of whether the first trial took place inside or outside. Since the defendant does not have to his credit the merit of Eretz Yisrael, we have no reason to expect a different result, even from a new court. The same law of no retrial would also apply if both courts were located in Eretz Yisrael, since no new merit of the Holy Land has been added to defendant's credit since the first trial. You hear what's going on over here? So it only works if you're going from Chutz Aretz to Eretz Yisrael with a different court. That's all. So in other words, were we bringing out now the merit of Eretz Yisrael? So therefore the Mishnah that's saying that if he comes to the same court, well, it was the same court. So the first case of the Mishnah speaking, he was tried first in outside of Israel. And now, even if the same court would see him and the same court is in Israel, well, it's the same court. We don't retry it. But it'd be a different court in Eretz Yisrael. Now the merit of Eretz Yisrael would help him. On the other hand, the next case is speaking where he was judged in Eretz Yisrael or not in Eretz Yisrael, but he's being caught in Chutz La'aretz. There's no merit to outside the land of Israel at all. Again, Israel is no merit if there's nothing has changed. Israel to Israel doesn't change anything. Bavel to Bavel doesn't change anything. Israel to Bavel doesn't change anything. Bavel to Israel with a different court will change. That becomes the difference over there. Okay. Let's stop it over here. Okay, we'll leave a little bit to finish up tomorrow. And then Amir Hashem will start the next parak next week.
The court is also from